Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. So today I'm delighted to be joined by Jess Seymour, who lost her husband only 10 months ago and remarkably is prepared to talk about what happened with me. I'm ever so grateful, Jess. Would you like to start by telling me the story of what happened to your husband, Matt?
Yeah, thank you for having me. So Matt was unfortunately, he was a very, very healthy person, wasn't even signed up at the GP when we were diagnosed, and he had a crippling pain in his stomach. And at first he was treating it for indigestion, and then we ended up being admitted to hospital and they thought it was pancreatitis because he had, on one of the scans, it came up with a lot of sort of inflammation there. He was sent home for 5 days and it just became worse and worse and worse to the point where we had to go back into A&E, and they eventually did scans and discovered that he had tumours around all of his vital organs, not in the organs, but around the organs. So he had quite some trouble with his bile ducts to his liver. It was causing him to be jaundiced, so that was a very visible sign of something being wrong because there was a tumour pushing against the bile duct. So he had 3 operations in total to try and sort of help things and put stints in and try and help with the pain. He was on a lot of pain relief, and then I think it was probably about 4 weeks in total before all the biopsy and everything came back to confirm exactly what the cancer was so that he could start chemotherapy. He had 4 rounds of chemotherapy, which were successful, very intensive rounds of chemotherapy over about 7-8 months. And then, very short version of the story, but he then came home. He had a PET scan and it showed that there was no sign of cancer, so we were absolutely relieved. But unfortunately, 2 months later, he was becoming very, very vacant, wasn't wanting to get out of bed, and I honestly thought it was depression. I thought, this is not Matt. Matt was very open and outward of speaking about things. He was very get up and go. Even with the chemotherapy, he was always wanting to do things and wanted to get back home and spend time with our little boy, Elijah. And then he just wasn't. And I ended up taking him back into the hospital to see Macmillan. And I said, you know, something's not right. I think he needs some therapy, some counselling, because he's obviously struggling with the change of his life and what his capabilities were after the cancer. And that's when they were trying to do some tests with him, and his memory was awful. He was then getting to the point where he didn't know why he was in hospital and asking why were we there. So
well,
they did
really difficult for you.
So difficult. And when you're a problem solver and not being able to find out what's going on, it was, I think I had that dread, but also that was probably the hardest part, because Matt wasn't aware, my husband wasn't aware of what was going on. So I didn't have that mutual discussion and connection with him at that point. And that's when they did a scan and realised that it had come back in his brain, which I think it was about a 2% chance that that would happen. So we obviously weren't expecting it.
So he was very unlucky.
Very, very unlucky. And he didn't have it in the brain before. So it hadn't actually gone into the central nervous system before at all. So it wasn't expected at all. And then they were still treating him with curative intent, so they were hoping that it would be cured. But unlike the first time, it was very, very positive that he would get through it, and he was a very healthy person. This was, it was hope for the best, but prepare for the worst. So there was then those discussions of the what ifs, and it became a little bit more of a deep discussion of what for the future, rather than just being this positive. You didn't want to be toxically positive, because you have to be realistic with the situation you're in. He had 2 rounds of chemotherapy that time, and unfortunately every time it shrunk, the tumour then grew back even bigger. It was almost fighting against the chemotherapy. And after you've had such a huge amount of chemotherapy in such a short amount of time, your bone marrow is just completely damaged. So it got to the point where his body wasn't for anyone who doesn't know, your bone marrow is what's sending out all of your cells to rejuvenate and sort of rebuild in your body. And the chemotherapy kills those bad cells off, but it also kills off the good cells. And his body just wasn't able to cope with regrowing those cells. So unfortunately, they had to stop the chemotherapy and they gave him palliative radiotherapy to try and reduce some of the symptoms. He had severe headaches and some of his vision was blurring a little bit. At some point, his speech would sort of go all mumbled and he looked like he was saying something that would make sense, but to me, it wasn't.
Did he recover his mental ability enough for you to have conversations?
Absolutely. And that's... I always... Actually, one of the ladies at the hospice always said to me, you're trying to look onto... It's like the glad game. You're basically... There's a bad situation, but you're trying to look at the positive side of things. And that's the one thing that I'm so grateful for, is even until the end, Matt was still mentally completely connected to me, knew what was happening. I was dreading that he would lose any memory, not know who I was, not know who Elijah was. But he was absolutely with it. Unfortunately, I think it was his body had just had enough. But it wasn't actually the brain tumour that kind of took over and took his life. It was all of the chemotherapy that he had to have to try and fight it.
But that means he was fully aware of the fact that he was dying.
Yeah, absolutely. And
how did he handle that?
He was incredible, absolutely incredible. The time that we went into the hospice and they said to him, you know, what would you like to eat? And he'd had months and months and months of this hospital food, which NHS is amazing, but the hospital food is something to be desired. And they said, you can have anything. And he said, oh, I want a steak. And then suddenly we've got the Hind's Head coming in for this amazing meal that we had on the lake. And it was just, he was still making the most of that time and still completely with it and thinking, how can I make memories whilst I'm here? And that was just Matt. He was just always optimistic, always positive, trying to make the most out of it every day. And when we found out he had the tumours in his brain, we said, right, we just need to be present. You know, you can't sit there and think what happens soon and ruin the time that you've got. You need to make the most of that time because you can worry about the future, but then you're missing out on what's actually happening at the moment.
You made that sound easy. That must be terribly hard for you in particular.
It is, but I think when you have that connection with somebody, you're on the same level. And I think that's one thing I was so grateful for, was that he was completely with it. So I could have that connection. Because, like I say, when he was diagnosed with the brain tumours, I really struggled because I didn't have his sort of... We were this unity and I didn't have that, which was really, really difficult.
You missed it. But you're not exactly in the same place, are you? Because one of you is going to go.
Yeah.
And the other's going to be left behind. But you found you could kind of ignore that and just be in the moment.
Yeah. Matt had a really nice... I mean, we weren't super spiritual, but he had a really nice spiritual experience that at the time I actually thought, oh, is his brain sort of playing tricks on him? Because he woke up a few days before he died and he said, oh, it's not my time to go yet. And I said, oh, okay. And he said, oh, they haven't found the key. I said, okay. They said, no, they haven't got the key. They need the key for the gate. And until they've got the key, I can't go. And the day that he died, he said to me, it's my time. You have to let me go now. Mm. And I had been there for nearly 3 weeks. I had no idea what the day of the week was. I had no idea what the date was. When I went home the night that he died, I said, I just want to go home. I just want to be at home with Elijah. I hadn't seen him properly in ages. And I woke up in the middle of the night and I thought, what's the date? And it was the 8th of the 8th, which in a spiritual world is called the opening of the Lion's Gate portal. So it's basically where all of these stars are all aligned and the gate opens. Mm-hmm. And it was just incredible how it all kind of pieced together. And I mean, it depends if you believe in that type of thing, but it just kind of happened. And I thought, this is just... there's definitely some sort of other world. I think that made it so much easier for me to accept that he's not completely gone. He is somewhere. And there is, I strongly believe there is another place that people go. And it's all kind of part of a divine process. And it doesn't, I wouldn't say everything happens for a reason, but it makes it a bit easier to think that he was actually completely at peace and like accepting where he was going.
Yes, he was kind of prepared and he knew when the time was right, which is... kind of comforting in a way.
Yeah,
is it for you?
I did have a bit of regret, and I think because I said to him when he said to me, "Are you ready to let me go?" And I said, "Yes." And I don't think anyone's ever ready to let anybody go. Whoever that relation is or whatever age, you're never ready to say, "Yeah, sure, okay, it's time for..."
But you were doing it for him, and you were kind of giving him permission.
And I think, I remember saying to the counsellor at the hospice, I lied to him, I feel awful about it. And she said to me, "Well, don't you think he lied to you? Because do you think he was ready to go? At 35 years old, when does anyone say, oh, actually, I've had my time, I'm ready to go now?" So I think we were both trying to make it easier for each other or more manageable. And that moment's never going to be easy. I have to say, I think before we met the hospice and the lovely people there, I was quite fearful of what that situation was going to be like. And Matt always said, "I don't want to die at home because I don't want to be a sad place and I don't want to have sad memories." Which I always thought he would rather die at home than be in a hospital, because as much as the hospital were amazing and the nurses and the doctors, they were like absolute angels and they were like family for us that time we were there, but it was still a place that he was having treatment. When you give up treatment, you almost feel a bit lost there. And that's where the hospice kind of takes its hold, because they kind of cocoon you in this, "We're here to look after you." And I'm so glad we made that decision, but I had no idea what the hospice was before.
And you heard about 3 weeks there, did you? Is that right?
Yeah.
Together. And what did happen to Elijah during that time?
So my brother and my best friend had Elijah most of the time. My parents, Matt's parents, everyone just kind of chipped in and helped where possible. Matt was very adamant in the hospice, and so many people wanted to come and visit him. He did see a few people and we had close family, but he just said, "I just want to be with you. I just want to have this time," because I think he just knew. He knew, he could always tell me, if I thought something, he would be able to tell me ahead of when I thought it. So I think he just knew what was important for me as well. And that was just Matt all over. He was just so selfless. And I think that time in the hospice, aside of not having the time with Elijah, he kept saying to me, "You will have that time, you know, in the future, you will have that time. And this time right now is to make the most of something you're not going to have." And that's exactly what we did.
And how old was Elijah at that point, and how much did he understand of what was going on?
So he was about a year and a half. So he was just completely like a joy. He'd come in and see Matt. He was aware that he had to be careful, you know, when he was climbing and things, but he was so used, Matt had a pig line in his arm for a long time, so he was so used to being careful and saying, "Oh, ouchie." So he wasn't awfully aware. Strangely, he probably mentions Matt more now than he did when he died. And I very much, from my own experiences, nothing against my mum. I don't know whether it was something that we did as children as a reaction to it, but my dad died when I was 2, and there was 3 of us, and it was just always, "Don't mention him because we don't want to upset mum." And we grew up being like that, and you just didn't talk about him. And Matt knew that, and I've spoken about everything with Matt, and he said to me, "I want Elijah to know exactly who I was, that even though I'm not there, he still has a dad and the part I played in his life." And Elijah was created because we wanted to have a family, so he needs to know how important he is. And I think since then, you know, I've got pictures up of him. We made a little Build-A-Bear teddy with Matt's voice on it on a recording. He's got a little teddy that's got Matt's face on it, which is lovely. But when I see that on the baby camera at night, it's a bit scary. But we've got lots of things. Matt did some of these books that he's got, and he's written in the front of some of his favourite books for Elijah. So he was really, really trying to make sure he had that. And Matt was adamant about, "I need to have a legacy. I don't want to be forgotten." So I've been trying to do as much as possible for the hospice, and also, you know, doing different things that Elijah can see in the future, how amazing his dad was and the impact that he had on people and his story, and how, you know, again, it's the glad game, a bad situation, you can make a positive out of it and make sure that other people are aware they can have a semi-positive experience out of something that's not what anyone would want in life. And don't get me wrong, have bad days. You know, I mean, we're sat in this room and there's a massive picture of a wave. I always with Matt, we always saw life as like being on a beach and you have waves and sometimes they're small waves and they're just ripples and it's safe and you can go into the sea and it's a nice safe day. And other days you get huge waves come over you and there is literally nothing you can do but just stay safe on the shore and know that it's not going to last forever and the next day might be different. And not thinking, oh, just because I've had a bad day, I've taken a step back in my grief journey, or, you know, that don't criticise yourself for how you're feeling. It's all totally normal. And the more you feel it and the less you suppress it, the more manageable it is. It doesn't get easier. It's just more manageable to deal with.
So is this the kind of conversation you had with Matt during that last 3 weeks?
Yeah, we spoke about everything. And I think when we had the meal from the Hind's Head, we literally sat there and I said, this is the most amazing meal. It's the most amazing location. They set up a nice table for us. We both had our outfits from our first date on. And it just felt really special. And we just had every conversation then that felt, you know, that knot in your throat where you just think this is so hard. But we had every conversation then. And I think for me, that's massively helped me now on my grief journey of... There isn't the what ifs or should I have said this or should I have said that and I haven't got the chance, or there is small regrets, but there's not huge regret. And I know that I did everything possible for Matt the whole time he had the treatment, helping him along with decisions and pushing him when he was really grumpy. You know, throughout chemotherapy it's horrible and he was pretty hard to deal with at times and very negative. I remember once telling him to get up and brush his teeth and he was so sarcastic with me saying, oh, this is going to make my life so much better because I'm brushing my teeth. He was really, really hard work, but we worked through it and we got through it. And I think it was the same in the hospice. If you just, you know, it's a horrible situation. And those last moments when he did die, it was really traumatic. I mean, I had to go back into the hospice a few days after because I just needed to talk through what happened, because from being an absolute control freak and being the one that can solve problems and can push for his care, to then just suddenly almost feeling like you're wiping your hands of it and going, okay, this is out of my hands, I actually can't do anything now, is mentally a really hard situation to put yourself in. When he did die, it was traumatic because he couldn't breathe. And I thought, well, I'm not doing anything about it. And he had the death rattle, you know, when you could hear. And he pulled me into him. And I think just lying there thinking, I'm not doing anything. He wanted me to be next to him. The hospice were amazing. They put a bed next to his so I could lie next to him. But I didn't do anything, and that for me was a really traumatic after, to think, should I have done something? Should they have tried to resuscitate him? Should they, you know, but there's all those questions you think you're just beating yourself up because it was inevitable, and you have to have a point where you do say, I just have to stop now. I can't do anything else. And I think even when he did die, we were all, you know, his family all came in, and his mum and dad were there at the time that he passed, and I think that was really important. But the rest of the family then came after and we were sat there in the room and I thought, I can still see him breathing. You know, you just, your mind just plays tricks on you because you don't want to accept that someone's gone. And I think we were probably in there for about an hour and then I just said, this is not right. You know, why are we just sitting here as if, it's not as if nothing's happened, but what happens now? Mm. And even then the hospice was so good with talking through everything. And I remember thinking, like, he's still here. Like, when we were in the room, he was still here. And it was only the moment that we walked him, I think it's called the Willow Suite, I can't remember the name, but where they take your loved ones when they pass. We took him down there and walked him down the corridor together. And literally the minute we left the room, I just thought, that's not him. And to me, there was this strange disassociation, which I didn't expect. And everyone was really upset, you know, obviously. But I just... suddenly, when I said goodbye, it didn't feel like I'd said goodbye like I did when he left us. It was like he was already gone. And again, that's created that spiritual feeling for me of there is something. We will never know what that is, will we? Whether you believe or not, you just don't know. And I think that's actually a mindset of why do we have to physically see something and it be a fact for it to be true in your world? And it doesn't mean it has to be right in everybody's world. But it's definitely a good mindset to have if you don't physically need to see something to manifest it or feel it or know that that is there. If you believe, then
that you believe the person is always with you.
Yeah. And I think your memories create that presence as well. You have those memories with people, and that's why we were so adamant about being present, because whatever moment you can create memories, and those memories create that whole vision of that person when they're not physically here. Don't get me wrong, there's nights when I lie and I cry my eyes out because I think I wish he was just here and I could just cuddle up to him, or when I'm making dinner and I think, oh, I can't be bothered. You know, you don't want to cook dinner for one person. Or when Elijah won't go to sleep and it's been 2 hours and I think you just want to hand the baton over and you don't have anybody to hand the baton over to. Those are those moments where you just think, this is not fair. But I do have moments where I say, I have my, what I call wallow with intent. So I sit there and I think, right, I need to have a moment, and I do, and then I move on. And it's all part of that process. And very much Matt was of the same thing as well with Elijah, of bringing him up to know that every emotion is okay. And there's such a huge amount of people, the way we're brought up is don't say the word dead, don't talk about death, you say past. You know, they're not passed by, they're not passing back. You've not lost them, you didn't, you know, it's not a pound coin you've dropped on the floor and you're going to find it later. They're gone. But I think there's such a taboo over talking about death and loss. And I think we had so many conversations before Matt went that it's felt so much more manageable now to talk about things. And I'm quite passionate with, I think from my experience when Matt did die, I found I was worrying more about other people's grief and how to deal with other people's emotions than my own, and how I was talking to people and I was adapting it to different people. And, you know, when people ask you, how are you? You feel the need to go, yeah, I'm all right. Because it's actually easier, because sometimes people can't manage your emotion and you feel like you're offloading to people. And I think it's strange the way we sort of grow up to think, oh, don't talk about the negative things. And unfortunately, it's the reality of life is you're born, you live, and then you die. It's just a matter of when those points happen. And even when we had Matt's funeral, you know, we said it's a celebration of his life. It's not a wake. We're celebrating who he was, and we really made that. We actually chose the venue where Matt and I always wanted to get married, which is quite local to us. And it was just stunning. And I thought, this is amazing that we can manage to have a celebration of him and make the most of those memories and keep them. And we did a lovely memory book that Elijah can have for when he's older. And we had a photo booth like you'd have at a wedding. So everyone had photos and they put their messages next to them, because I thought in years to come, and Elijah says to me, who's that? And I think, how do I explain if you're not seeing them all the time? And all those people that were important in Matt's life are all in that book now for Elijah when he's older.
And you've talked about having been honest with Elijah. So he knows his daddy's dead.
Yes, yeah.
And you think he understands that he's never coming back?
Absolutely. He has amazed me with his understanding. And he's only 2 and a half now. He's had situations where I think, is he seeing Matt? He's had so many strange situations. Even one day I had a cup and it was Matt's cup. And Elijah wouldn't know that. I hadn't had it out the cupboard for ages. And Elijah just went, oh, that's daddy's cup. And I said, all right, okay. And he was talking away to somebody next to him. And literally they're going, oh, dada. And some of the words at the moment still don't make sense. And then he just looked me straight in the eye and said, daddy's dead. And you think, well, how does he have a concept of that? How does he know? And I had this plan that when he got a bit older, we'd have, you know, a plant and it would be alive, and then I'd explain when it dies, which is not difficult for me. Don't keep houseplants alive very easily. I thought then I could explain to him, but it's happened already. He gets it. And even at nursery, I've said to them, you can talk about daddy. Like, you don't need to avoid it. Please make sure you talk to him about it. And I explained to him that he's died and he's gone. And how much of that understanding of what that means, I don't know. And he does talk about him, and he's got stars above his bed, and he says, you know, he's up, daddy's up there. What that association to him means, I don't know. But I think it's so important that I would just constantly talk to him about it, so he doesn't ever feel like he doesn't understand and he makes his own mind up as to what that is. I think when you're younger and you lose a parent, you can feel slightly sort of not abandoned, that might be a bit of a strong word, but sort of like something's been taken away from you, and you can feel a bit angry about it. And I think with Elijah, I just want to make sure that if he does, that he talks to me about it. And the more I talk about Matt now, hopefully the more he'll find that easier to talk. And Matt was, for a man, he spoke about all his emotions. The minute he was diagnosed with cancer, he decided to start doing a podcast himself and recording kind of the highs and the lows and what's happened. And that was just Matt all over. He was just always talking and always very open about his emotions. I think both of us thought we really want Elijah to grow up the same and not be sort of introverted and not be able to share his feelings and talk about things. So I think as well, just explaining to Elijah that it's okay to say dead and death, and you don't have to tiptoe around certain things, because in our house it's safe and it's okay. And I think for a child, they do need to understand that what you do affects other people's emotions, but they shouldn't feel that you have to hold back how you feel because you're worried about your parents' feelings. Your parents are there to nurture you and protect you. It shouldn't be the other way around. And it's definitely a case of making sure that he has that comfortable environment to talk.
Well, you mentioned just now how you adapt what you say for the sake of other people, but yeah, you're trying to encourage him not to do that,
yeah,
aren't you? It is a kind of politeness, I think, we grow up with, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Which is rather annoying that we have to have it when we encounter death, I think.
I know. It's very strange. Even when people find out somebody's got cancer, it's this almost, people feel awkward. Mm. They don't know what to say. Or any life-threatening illness, and the minute you say end-of-life care, people just... It's just... I think it instills, like, a fear in people because it's the unknown.
Did you have any fear?
With Matt dying?
Mm.
I didn't have a fear about how it would happen once we'd gone into the hospice. I was very comfortable that he would be not in pain because he had a syringe driver put in on the last day. He was very stubborn with medication and never wanted pain relief. I mean, even the whole time he had the brain tumours, he only had paracetamol. He was crazy. So he had the syringe driver for the pain. He felt a bit anxious himself, but he had a lady, Catherine, who you've done a podcast with, Catherine Beer, who very much was there as his emotional support in that respect. And when she would talk to him, I would leave the room and give him that space so he didn't feel like he was doing anything for my sake. And he had a fear. I think I feared the future for Elijah not having his dad. And I knew that I didn't want to not have him there, but I knew the reality was that he was going. So it wasn't necessarily a fear. It was just a bit of kind of, I would say anger, you know, it's not fair. And the idea that I won't have him around for the future is horrible, and it still hits me some days now like it's just happened. But I think that the fear is Elijah feeling like hard done by because he doesn't have his dad. I think that for me was my biggest fear.
And that's something that you might well encounter. He might end up being angry, but you're at least you're aware of it and prepared for it,
yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah.
But you described earlier on those 3 weeks when you had time to talk about everything. I'm trying to get my head into that space. I'm trying to understand what that could be like.
What because, we would talk about them.
Yes, because I just can't imagine doing it without being constantly in tears.
Yeah. Matt had these incredible blue eyes that you could look into and you could just read him. Like, he just had these such deep blue eyes. And the moment I met him, I just knew that I could say anything to him. And he also knew that I run away with my thoughts. So if I start thinking something, I then start thinking, but what if, but what if? And he would always bring me back down and say, right, what's actually happening right now? And we did have a lot of tears, a lot of tears, a lot of hugs that you think I don't want to actually let go. And I mean, even when he died, I was literally, my head was in his neck, like in his shoulders, and I did not want to let him go. And I think talking about making sure we had our wills sorted and what his wishes were for Elijah, and you know, the worst situation that could happen, what was if I was to die, who would he want Elijah to go to? Who did he want Elijah's godparents to be? Because we haven't managed to get him christened yet because of everything. I mean, Elijah was only 5 months old when Matt was diagnosed, and everything else unfortunately kind of took a step back. It's so hard, but I think talking about the what ifs and what's going to happen, and you know, even questions like Matt asked me some really difficult questions. He said to me, do you think you'll ever be with anybody else?
You're not going to say yes at that point, are you?
No, but I said to him, as long as Elijah and I are happy, I don't know what my future entails. And I remember he said to me, well, sorry, I shouldn't ask you that question. But we literally had those conversations that you just talk about anything. He said to me, are you going to stay in the house that we've bought? You know, are you going to stay here? And I said, I think we'll stay here until Elijah's old enough that we can find a place that we like ourselves together. And he has a big part of that. We've never been materialistic people. We've never been, you know, that thing of that connection to one thing. So for me, a house is somewhere that you keep safe and you make it your home. But who you have in your family are the most important things, not where you live. But having said that, he still asked me those questions because I think it's those questions that he would never be there to find out. I know that, for instance, he really wants Elijah to play football when he's older. Matt loved football, absolutely loved it. He loved racing cars, so he loved going to the Formula One. You know, him and his family are car obsessed. So Matt said to me, you know, what are you going to do with my ashes? And I said, well, what do you want us to do with your ashes? And typically Matt chose 6 different places to scatter his ashes. Not needy at all. But those conversations you don't want to have. But if you don't, you get to the point and you think, well, what do I do? Before Matt even got poorly, I wouldn't have known if he wanted to be buried or cremated. He said to me that he didn't want any of his ashes to be buried because he didn't want to be under the ground. He wanted to be free. He hasn't got anywhere that he has as a headstone or anything. And those conversations is really difficult. Like, literally, you feel nauseous when you're having those conversations and you have a knot in your neck because you feel that, you know, that physical pain in your chest. But I'm so glad we had them. And that time at the hospice just created that kind of comfortable, relaxing environment where I didn't have to care for him then. The whole time before, I was his number one person. And in the hospice, you could have those conversations that if I'd have been, you know, looking after him physically, probably wouldn't. I would have been in a very different mindset and kind of go, 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 rather than actually just stopping and being present and having those conversations. But probably some of the hardest conversations I think I will ever have in my life. And especially when it's that whole acceptance thing that somebody is going, those conversations make it real. It's not just a if and when, it's happening. And I think those conversations are so hard. But on the flip side, I think it would have been harder to not have had them and always question what Matt would have wanted. Am I doing the right thing? Is this what he would have done? If I hadn't have had those conversations, I think I would have just been left with those unanswered questions forever. And that's really, really hard to deal with when you're already grieving the loss of somebody, is questioning yourself and criticising yourself for the decisions you make. So I would strongly say to people, you know, however hard it is, it's still more manageable. I'd never say easy, because nothing's easy to do with grief or losing somebody, but it's more manageable to have those conversations before, however hard or gut-wrenching they feel, than to not have it, because you just never have that opportunity.
I find it very moving, everything you say, and I can't help thinking you're very brave, but I've got a feeling you're going to tell me you're not brave, you just went through what you had to.
Yeah, I think people say, oh, I don't know how you did it, I don't know how you go through what you're doing, and I couldn't do it. And if somebody said to me 2-3 years ago this would all happen, I would have said there's no way I would get through that. No way. And I don't think I'm brave. I think we just made a strong decision together about his care and his end of life. And I know that I've not missed anything. I know that there isn't anything I could have done more for him. And there's days where I really don't feel brave. There's days where I come home and, you know, work full time, Elijah's at nursery, and I'll come home and pick him up and I think, I can't do this. You know, even the smallest things of getting him in the bath and getting him to bed, sometimes I just think I don't have any energy in me. You feel a bit like a hamster in a wheel sometimes, where you're just going, 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 going. And then you have a day where you just plummet. And that's the day when it feels so hard to stop and really feel your feelings, because there is everyday life. And unfortunately, when you lose somebody, you do still have to carry on. But you have those moments sometimes where you just stop and you really think about what's happened and what's happening and what is going on for the future of your life and how it's not what you planned. And that is so hard.
Yeah, you have to grieve for the things in the future too.
Yeah, those things, those memories that you always thought, you know, you imagine when you meet the person that you want to be with for the rest of your life. That is, I remember Matt said to me, I'm not dating anyone unless it's a contract for life, when he met me. And it is true, you expect that is a contract for life, but you expect that you're going to live to a ripe age together. It's, you feel robbed. You think, well, I haven't had that time with them. We were quite, again, it's that glad game, but we were quite lucky because when we moved into our house in 2019, we then moved in. We had COVID, so we spent so much time together. Then we were pregnant, so we had Elijah. So then I was on maternity leave and Matt was working from home. And then the whole time he was having treatment, we were so lucky in all that time that we had together over that 2020 to when he passed away in 2023. The amount of hours that we probably spent together is probably what people would spend over 15 years. Like, it was non-stop. I think when you can spend that amount of time with somebody and still cope with them, you know it's the right person.
But I can so identify with what you say about coming home sometimes with Elijah and not having that extra bit of energy to do all the things you have to do, because you haven't just not got someone to share the putting to bed with. You've not got somebody to share, oh dear, I feel too tired to do it.
Exactly, yeah. And I think sometimes as well, you know, my manager has been absolutely amazing and I work from home one day a week now, and that to me is labelled as my I don't need to put a face on today. Because I go into work and you do have to just get on with work and crack on, and I've got a very supportive team and everyone knows, but that day that I work from home is my day just to, if grief hits me like a wave, I just roll with it. Whereas sometimes if I'm at work and I feel something just reminds me or something triggers, there isn't always a natural trigger that you can label and say that's been my trigger today. But I will say to myself, it's okay, box that up and later we can deal with that. I remember the first time I really cried after it really hit me that he wasn't coming back. And I think it was after his funeral and we'd all come home, and then it was kind of, I focused myself so much on the funeral and then making sure we were doing everything for him. And it was, honestly, I was completely OTT because I thought, this is the one time we get to do this. And afterwards, the first time I really cried, and I started crying and I covered my face with my hands. I started thinking, if I cry normally, you just have tears coming out of your eyes and I don't cover my face. And I thought, what am I doing? And then I started to realise it was almost like a suppression of the emotion. I was sort of covering my face to stop myself having any external sort of input to how I was feeling, and it was almost like I cry a little bit and then stop, and then I cry a little bit and then stop, and I kept covering my face. I thought, what am I doing? No one's in the room, they can't see me crying. They can't see my ugly crying face. But I just kept covering my face, and when I had the counselling, I kind of brought that up and then realised it was like, it was me thinking, no, I can't do this. Like, I have to be the strong person, because the whole time Matt was having treatment, I was a strong person. I was the one communicating with everyone with the treatment. And when, you know, when we knew it wasn't going to be cured, I had to be the one to tell everybody. And it was suddenly this moment I thought, I don't need to be that person anymore. Like, I can be what I need to be. And this is actually about me now. And if I don't look after myself, and I don't mentally and physically, I can't look after Elijah. And I kept thinking, what would Matt say? Matt wouldn't say, just hold it in. He'd say, just let it go. Just let it out. Let those feelings out. And I think those moments that you said to me earlier, you know, you sound brave. I don't think there's even like a case of being brave or not brave. I think being brave is actually being vulnerable and talking to people about your emotions and sharing the ups and downs and the reality of grieving. Is it's not pretty. You know, it's not a case of just standing there saying, I'm amazing and I've got through this. Grief doesn't ever leave you. I feel like the grief is just surrounding me, but there's times where I sort of touch it and knock it, and then there's other times where I can sort of have my own space and not feeling guilty for being happy or having those happy moments, and just kind of realizing that the bravest thing you can possibly do is actually show your vulnerability. And I had one session where I really talked through with my counsellor at the hospice those last moments with Matt. And it was the one thing that I could talk about anything, but those last moments I found really, really difficult, because it was the moment I had to let go of the control and the problem solving, and I had to just admit that I couldn't do anything about it. And I had a session and I cried and cried and cried, and it was, you know, when you're really crying and it's almost like you're not breathing, because you just, it actually hurts to cry that much. And afterwards I just felt like someone had just individually just been taking bricks off of my shoulders and my head. It just felt incredible. And that's when I realised it was up to me to get through those situations and understand myself by letting myself feel those feelings and be vulnerable and go through each of those emotions at different points whenever I need to. I remember I had one day, and it was only about a month ago, and I had a day off work, and Elijah, I took him to nursery, and I had this immense guilt of, why am I taking him to nursery when I've got the day off work? But I sat on the sofa and I tried to watch TV. I tried to make something nice to eat because I rarely get time to cook anything. And I just felt so anxious because I'd stopped, and that's thinking time. And that's the time you have to really sit there and think about what's happening. And I cried and cried and cried and cried. And I just sat there and said to myself, you've got to go through this. You have to sit there and have this moment. And it was so hard. But I felt so much better the next day. But there's no matter if I could have, you know, I remember my neighbour said, oh, how are you? I said, I had a bad day last week. And she said, oh, you should have said I could have come over. And you think, it's amazing you've got that support, but nobody is going to give you, the one person you want to talk to is the one person that's not here. And it's not against anybody else, but the reason you're sad is because you want that person and they're the one that you can't talk to. So you realise the only person that's going to help you get through it is your own thoughts, and you need to just kind of ride with them. But it is so lonely.
Jess Seymour, thank you so much. You've been wonderfully open and I'm sure enormously helpful to a lot of people.
Thank you very much for having me.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.